This is a podcast of ABC Radio National's Background Briefing. This program can be heard broadcast or streamed from ABC Radio National. Details of frequencies, times and more downloads, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, I'm James Carlton, and you may remember several months ago, Background Briefing had a program on the new science of happiness, based on the work by economics professor Lord Richard Layard. Happiness, what it is, and how to get it. It certainly was a very popular subject with listeners, and today we're having another stab at it, again with Lord Layard, but this time his ideas are debated by a psychiatrist, Professor Raj Prasad. Lord Layard says the state can and should concentrate more on creating happiness in society. And studies across countries and across time now give us a pretty good idea about the social conditions needed to make people happier. Psychiatrist Raj Prasad, on the other hand, says happiness is elusive and personal, and the state should keep out of it. He tells the cautionary tale of the Brave New World Aldous Huxley created, where everyone, except one, is in ignorant bliss thanks to the drug Soma.
Only one character in Huxley's novel, the savage, is recognised to be human, and he claims the right to be unhappy. At the end of Brave New World, the rebel, John, otherwise known as the savage, confronts the controller. Universal happiness, the controller admits, has been achieved by shifting the emphasis away from truth and beauty and towards comfort. Art and science have become impossible because they require challenge, skill, and frustration. Happiness has got to be paid for somehow, and the guarantee of comfort requires losing other experiences that are part of being human. Says the savage, but I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin. In fact, said the controller, you're claiming the right to be unhappy. Continues the controller, not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent, the right to have syphilis and cancer, the right to have too little to eat, the right to be lousy, the right to live in constant apprehension of what may happen tomorrow, the right to catch typhoid, the right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind. There was a long silence. I claim them all, said the savage at last.
You'll hear Raj Prasad's speech in about 10 minutes. First, from the Centre for Economic Performance in London, Lord Layard sets out his basic thesis. He says the emotional state of citizens should be of great importance to politicians. And while he doesn't advocate regulation, he does point out that there is no such thing as a society free of politics. Whether the state is actively engaged or not, the state is having an effect. And just to give you a little more background, it's now well accepted that provided you've got at least a reasonable income, that money by itself does not make you happier. And yet, the greatest predictor of unhappiness, Richard Layard says, is still real poverty and hardship, with mental illness a close second.
Unfortunately, this is not the way the government has been thinking up to now. Psychiatry and psychology have been Cinderella sections of the NHS. If you have blood pressure, I have, or a skin problem, or asthma, or diabetes, or whatever, you will almost automatically, at some point, see a specialist. But not if you have a crippling depression, which is stopping you from working for a year. You're extremely unlikely to see a specialist. Not more than 10% of people in that condition will see a specialist. And this reflects, I think, our obsession at the moment with, quote, objective indicators, rather than the feelings of people, which are what I believe matter most of all. So it's encouraging that by pointing out some of these facts, there is now a move going on in the government to provide more psychological therapy, which is, of course, what these patients want. They just don't want to be put on a few pills by the GP and sent off home. Let me go on to work. All happiness surveys show that unemployment is one of the greatest causes of unhappiness, similar in the size of its effect to the effect of being divorced or bereaved. And actually three times worse in its effect than, for example, losing as much as 30% of your income. So that's why any civilized society tries to reduce unemployment as far as possible. And I don't know if Raj is going to talk about it, but there's a chapter in his book about it here, where he's arguing, and I agree with him, that particularly in France and Germany, a lot of that unemployment is due to inappropriate benefit policies, giving people benefits without attaching any conditions that they should accept jobs that are different from the ones they did before. So you've seen in France and Germany the coexistence of very high unemployment with often very high vacancies. I think that's wrong. I think it's based on the wrong philosophy for the welfare state, where people are seen as victims and they're not expected to take steps to improve themselves, even if they may be less than ideal. And as I've just shown you from the evidence, almost any work is better than no work, and that's what the authorities who try to help unemployed people should be allowed to take into account. Let me move on to income. I've said it's less important than work, but things which make us want more income make us less happy. And, of course, that's advertising. And it seems to me that kind of pictorial advertising, which we're exposed to all the time, and our children, are making people feel less and less satisfied with any particular amount of money that they have. Sweden has banned advertising directed at children under 12. I think there's quite a case in our own country for not only that, but also considering whether pictorial advertising, if it has these bad effects, ought to be settable against corporation tax. Finally, let me end on values. Some people think values are a private matter. Of course, they never have been. In every society, people have been concerned with the values which other people's children absorb, because they affect all of us. So it's very important what kind of values are being offered to our children in our schools. Now, in a recent WHO survey, this is of 11 to 15-year-olds, they were asked, do you agree with the statement that most of the students in my classes are kind and helpful? Here's the answers. Sweden, 77%, yes. Germany, 76. Denmark, 73. USA, 53. Russia, 46. England, 43. Now, I think that this is a pretty depressing picture, and it corresponds rather closely to another set of questions which have often been asked of the population, and namely, do you think most other people can be trusted? In Scandinavia, again, you're up in very high numbers, and in Britain, much lower, and in both Britain and the USA, the numbers saying yes have halved in the last 40 years. And I attribute this to the growth of individualism. And it's interesting that on the continent, the numbers of people who think other people can be trusted has not fallen. So by individualism, I mean the belief, which I think is becoming increasingly spread about by teachers, parents, media, that your main duty is to make the most of yourself, make the most of your life. This may be where we're going to disagree. The extreme version of this is that your job is to get ahead of other people. Getting ahead is, of course, a completely hopeless objective for a society, because it's impossible for everybody to get ahead of everybody else. It's a zero-sum game, and we shouldn't be getting people putting their energy into zero-sum games. So I want schools to teach people that their job is to contribute to the happiness of others and to find happiness from doing that. My feeling, however, is that it's difficult for schools on their own to change a society or to change a culture. So I'm currently looking, in case there happens to be anybody here, I'm looking for a city. I think you could do this perhaps more at the level of a city. If you could get a city to decide that its aim was to be a friendly city, in which people felt the world was a friendly place, that was taught in schools, that was the ethos of local services, how they related to citizens, ethos of the police, ethos in the NHS, if that was what employers thought was their job to help enable their workers to lead satisfying lives and to feel that the world was on their side. I think we could do an interesting experiment, because we could measure the outcomes. You know, what is this doing to mental health admissions? What is this doing to offending rates? Now, Albert Einstein once said that the key question is whether the universe is a friendly place. I think that's a rather big question, but I do think that the key question is whether the world is a friendly place, and I do think the government can do a lot to determine how we answer that question. Thank you.
Professor Richard Layard is the author of Happiness, Lessons from a New Science. And if you'd like a fuller explanation of his ideas, you can also go to the Background Briefing website and look for the transcript of the first program featuring Lord Layard. It went to air on April 17. This is ABC Radio National. Next to speak at the London School of Economics was Professor of Psychiatry, Raj Pinod. His ideas are set out in his book, The Motivated Mind, and he argues for a more personal approach.
Harold Macmillan, a former British Prime Minister from several decades ago, was visiting France on a state visit and happened to find himself with a few private moments with the wife of President Charles de Gaulle, Madame de Gaulle. He asked her what she was most looking forward to on the retirement, the imminent retirement, of President Charles de Gaulle. He was somewhat startled and shocked at her reply. When asked what she was most looking forward to on President de Gaulle's retirement, she said, a penis. It was only later on reflection that Macmillan realized that what she was trying to say under a heavy French accent was happiness. And right there, you have the problem at the heart of happiness. Which is that when people are talking about it, they're not often talking about exactly the same thing. Now, Richard Layard has done some important work in that he has reorientated the project of politics and economics towards emotions and well-being. And in so doing, he's pushing psychology into the center of public policy. And in taking issue with some of what's in the book, I want to emphasize I don't want to refute a lot of what he says, but perhaps try to broaden the debate. In particular, I will take issue with his definition of happiness, the way it's measured, and whether we should take personal responsibility for our own happiness. The social sciences in general have rather neglected the issue of emotions. And that is because emotions traditionally have been difficult to measure, and whenever scientists find something difficult to measure, they tend to neglect it. But happiness isn't just a real thing, as spotted on brain scanning studies, it's actually a real biological entity. Happy people smell differently to unhappy people. A recent study did an experiment where psychologists took people and showed them funny films that would cheer them up, or showed them horror films that would scare them, and took swabs, gauze swabs of their armpits while they were watching these films. They then gave these gauze swabs to a completely independent group of people a week later and asked them to smell them. And this independent group of people could reliably identify the happy people as opposed to the scared people. Now, just because something can be measured doesn't necessarily mean it's important. Aristotle, way back 2,000 years ago, argued that actually happiness was the central issue in our lives. And his argument went something along the lines of this. He said that when you ask people why they do stuff, like, for example, why they earn money, why they go to work, why they get married, they always say, ultimately, they do these things because they think these things will make them happy. But when you ask them, why are you trying to be happy, they never have another purpose, another cause, beyond the pursuit of happiness itself. Since all pathways of human activity, therefore, lead causally, in terms of reasoning as to why people do stuff, back to happiness, then happiness, he argued, must be the ultimate goal in life. And that argument has kind of more or less stood fairly unchallenged for about 2,000 years of Western thought. But it has begun to be recently challenged by evolutionary biologists, who argue that actually there is a purpose beyond the pursuit of happiness in life. And that is based on the idea that we are biologically wired up in our genes and our brains to experience emotions because these emotions help us survive and help us pass on our genes to future generations. So take the emotion of fear. Fear and anxiety are deeply unpleasant emotions. Yet our ancestors, in experiencing fear and anxiety, these emotions helped them avoid things like the edges of cliffs and predators bounding towards them. And because they avoided these things, they lived to pass on these genes to future generations. And that explains why neurosis exists. Neurotic people, millions of years ago, were extra vigilant for hazards in the local environment compared to non-neurotic people. And because of this extra vigilance, they actually did detect a few hazards, and that helped them pass on their genes to future generations. Now, in order to understand the evolutionary purpose of happiness, you need to understand what psychologists believe happiness is constituted of. And psychologists believe you can dissect happiness into two basic key components, referred to, for want of a better word, as level one happiness and level two happiness. And when I use the terms level one and level two, I don't mean in any sense to say that level two is in some way a better form of happiness than level one. But basically, level one happiness is the kind of hedonistic pleasure that you get from a nice glass of wine, seeing a nice film, having a nice meal. And that's a feeling state, a pleasurable state. It tends to be rather intense, but it tends to be rather temporary. Indeed, psychologists have attempted to measure how long level one happiness lasts, and generally speaking, it lasts around 15 minutes. There is another kind of happiness, though, called level two happiness. This is a more cognitive, intellectual element of happiness. And this is the kind of satisfaction and contentment you feel when you look at your life and think about past achievements and think about the general direction that your life is heading in. Now, that form of happiness is less intense than level one happiness, but it is longer lasting. Now, the reason why it's very important to think about level two happiness as well as level one when we're talking about happiness goes back to William James, who was one of the founding fathers of psychology. He put it like this. He said, "If merely feeling good could decide the state of well-being, then mild drunkenness would be the supremely valid human experience." Notice something very important about level one and level two happiness. They are frequently in conflict with each other. If you do too much level one happiness, then you won't really get to achieve much level two happiness. Also, if you dedicate your life purely to level two happiness, then you won't experience much level one happiness, and maybe your life will be lacking something as a result. Now, let's say we were to measure the happiness of people in this room and score it on a scale between 1 and 10. What you would find is a large group of people would be scoring around 6 on this 1 to 10 scale of happiness, where 10 was ecstatic happiness and 1 was suicidal despair. Let's call the people who are hitting around 6 the mildly content. There'll be some people out there listening to my words as I speak who'll be hitting 10, who'll be deliriously ecstatic as I'm talking. And these people really need to get out more. Now, what's really fascinating is if we were to measure these people's happiness in about a year's time, we would discover that the mildly content, the people scoring around 6, would, lo and behold, still roughly be scoring around 6 in about a year's time. But the people who are scoring 9 or 10, they're very unlikely to be scoring 9 or 10 in a year's time. Their happiness is much more intense but much more fragile, and they're likely to be hitting 0, 1 or 2 in around a year's time. Some people's lives are a roller coaster ride of emotions. They're swinging from one extreme to the other, where there's another group of people who are much more stable, and they're hitting around 4, 5, or 6. Now, here is the answer to one of the great secrets of happiness. And that is, if you want sustained well-being in the long run, you need to aim to hit around 6, and not aim to hit around 10. That is the great secret at the heart of happiness, and that means the secret at the heart of happiness is to aim for mild contentment. There is an important point there, which is that it may well be that what we need to debate is not just how much happiness people have or the intensity experience, but what is sustainable in the long run.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. At this point, Professor Raj Prasad talked of the philosopher Solon, who, around 600 BC, said that no man could be described as happy until he is dead.
Now, what's really interesting about Solon is that this begins a long strand of Western intellectual thought where intellectuals and academics begin to think about happiness and basically become happiness pessimists. They don't really subscribe to the idea that happiness is something we should subscribe to or aspire to. What I'm going to do is read out some quotes from Western intellectuals and see if you can identify who they are. This one is, "One feels inclined to say that the intention that man should be happy is not included in the plan of creation." That was Freud. Freud also said, the best that can be hoped for in life was the transformation of hysteric misery into common unhappiness. Here's another quote. The existentialist says at once that man is in anguish. That's Sartre. Throughout the ages, the wisest of men have passed the same judgment of life. It is no good. Nietzsche. I don't know why we're here, but I'm pretty sure that it's not in order to enjoy ourselves. Wittgenstein. Today it is bad, and day by day it will get worse. Until at last the worst of all arrives. Schopenhauer. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can, and don't have any kids yourself. Philip Larkin, the great poet. Now, what's really interesting, in contrast to intellectuals and academics who are happiness pessimists, what happens when you look at what ordinary people on the street feel in terms of happiness? And you discover really something quite astonishing, that most ordinary people rate themselves as really rather happy. When happiness is kind of rated on these scales, the average number that most people in most countries score is around 7.5. In most countries, the self-professed happy outnumber the unhappy by a ratio of 3-1. So, generally speaking, there's a lot of happiness out there. And maybe one of the problems with Richard's project is right there, which is that given that people really are rather happy as they are, maybe it's going to be very difficult on average to raise their happiness any higher. And statisticians call that a ceiling effect. Maybe there's so much happiness out there in modern capitalist Western liberal societies that I'm afraid to tell you, basically, this could be as good as it gets. However, Switzerland, the country that scores highest on average happiness, the average score for happiness in Switzerland on a scale from 0 to 10 is an astonishing 8.39. And the statisticians think that basically means either there are no discontented people in Switzerland at all, or some people when filling out the forms are cheating and are so deliriously happy they're putting a number down higher than 10. Now, the intellectuals, who are more happiness pessimists, come up with a different argument. They say maybe why you're detecting all this happiness out there is because when you ask people how happy they are, when they respond, they're not really thinking very clearly or sensibly about their answer. So they're not giving you really a very profound answer. And there's a clue that that might be right from another interesting study done recently by psychologists. They engineer a situation where people have to go and make some photocopies from a photocopying machine. Unbeknownst to these people, they don't know the experimenter has engineered it, that they will discover a 10-cent dime on the photocopying machine, an unexpected discovery. So one group find the 10-cent dime, the other group who are photocopying don't find anything. Then they're interviewed shortly afterwards about how happy they are. But the happiness question doesn't ask them how happy you are right now. It asks them, tell us how you evaluate how happy your whole life has been. In other words, they ask people to evaluate happiness over their whole lifetime. The amazing result is the discovery of a 10-cent dime piece on a photocopy machine statistically significantly raises your assessment of how happy your whole life has been. The implications are dramatic for government policy. It suggests the cheapest and most effective public policy measures imaginable. But here you see a secret as to the difficulty in raising people's happiness, which is it was the unexpected nature of the discovery that raised their happiness. And that's one of the problems. How do you make it unexpected that people have positive events if it's the unexpected nature that adds to their happiness? Well, yes, but how could great thinkers like Freud and Wittgenstein get it so wrong? How could it be they could be such happiness pessimists and ordinary people are scoring so high on happiness? Well, the psychiatrist has an answer for that. It says, actually, you just need to look at these intellectuals and academics to understand why they're so pessimistic, because they're very different from ordinary people. Basically, they're what we call neurotic. They're introverted, they think a lot, they obsess, they ruminate, they're socially isolated, and no wonder that kind of mental equipment predisposes them to be rather pessimistic about life. In other words, ironically, the very people who appear to be most qualified to comment on happiness are actually the least qualified. But there's another interesting difference between intellectuals and the rest of the population, which is that intellectuals tend to be what psychologists call internal in orientation. Internality and externality are two key dimensions that psychologists feel you can divide the population over. Internals are people who take responsibility for their lives. They believe that they can have an impact on the future of their life, on their destiny. And they believe their destiny is in their hands. Externals, on the other hand, believe that their life is down to external forces beyond their control, and they have very limited ability to control their future. This key dimension has a profound effect on behavior. Internals tend to vote. Externals tend not to vote. Internals vote because they believe they can have an impact on the political system. Internals tend not to commit crime because they believe in the value of hard work. Externals don't believe in the value of hard work, so they tend to take shortcuts. And externals are more prone to various psychological problems. Now, here's the fascinating result. A psychologist called Jean Twenge, based in the US, has been looking, doing a meta-analysis of internality and externality in the population way back to the 1960s, the early 60s, when it first began to be measured. And she has discovered an alarming shift in the general population on this dimension, to the extent that the general population has shifted alarmingly in the direction of more externality. To the extent that the average young person today, around the age of an LSE student, is more external than 80% of people of the same age around in the early 60s. That is a dramatic shift in externality. And it has dramatic implications for happiness, which we'll come to in a second. But one of the questions is this: why is the population getting more external? Why is it they're not taking personal responsibility for their lives? Now, there are various theories. One profession that's blamed are the lawyers. The lawyers have this interesting habit of coming up to you at a cocktail party and saying things like, "I happen to notice you're really rather overweight. Let me sue McDonald's for you, because it's quite clear these big fast food corporations have made you overweight." As you trip over your paving stone outside your front door, a lawyer will appear magically and press his card into your broken hand and say, "Let me sue the local council for you for placing this paving stone to trip you up right here." So it's the rise of the blame culture that might be pushing the population in a more external direction. There's another interesting profession that are blamed, and that is people like Richard and myself, social scientists, psychologists, and psychiatrists. The idea here is the rise of the social science explanation is squeezing out personal responsibility. That people now say, "Well, you know, it's my genes that made me do it. It's my childhood. It's my dreadful parents. It's the terrible school I got sent to. It's society that made me do it." And this squeezing out of personal responsibility means that people are much more external in orientation. And it has dramatic implications for happiness, because externals feel happier in the short run, because when bad things happen to them, they can always blame someone else for why it happened to them. But in the long run, because they don't take personal responsibility for their lives, they're not going to be successful. Internals have a tougher time in the short run. When they go for a job interview and they fail it, and they take personal responsibility for the failure, they feel terrible in the short run. But because they take personal responsibility for their lives and work harder, in the long run, life is better for them. They do better, certainly, on level two happiness. Now we come to the key point about the evolutionary purpose of level one or level two happiness. It's obvious evolutionarily why we have level one happiness. It's obvious why we're genetically programmed to derive pleasure from sex and from eating, because those things help pass on our genes. But level two happiness, no other animal in the animal kingdom experiences level two happiness, because we are the only animals that can think and can plan for the future. So we are the only people who are able to experience level two happiness. So might it not be that actually that's kind of important? It's kind of important that we sometimes choose difficult challenges that we then overcome and we grow as a result. And actually, our key evolutionary advantage over every other species is the fact that we could suspend level one happiness, plan for the future, do difficult stuff today that led to personal growth. Aldous Huxley, in 1932, penned a novel called Brave New World, which penned a chilling futuristic vision of an all-powerful state in which the masses are kept under control with a drug called Soma, which banishes all unhappiness. Many have seen Soma as a prophetic anticipation of Prozac. Liberal quantities of Soma ensure that everyone is content, well-behaved, and free from any disruptively original or subversive thoughts. Should anyone feel a tinge of dissatisfaction or anxiety, they are told to take a gram of Soma, which is said to have all the advantages of Christianity and alcohol, but none of their defects. Only one character in Huxley's novel, The Savage, is recognized to be human, and he claims the right to be unhappy. At the end of Brave New World, the rebel, John, otherwise known as the Savage, confronts the controller. Universal happiness, the controller admits, has been achieved by shifting the emphasis away from truth and beauty and towards comfort. Art and science have become impossible because they require challenge, skill, and frustration. Happiness has got to be paid for somehow, and the guarantee of comfort requires losing other experiences that are part of being human. Says the savage, but I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin. In fact, said the controller, you're claiming the right to be unhappy. Continues the controller, not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent, the right to have syphilis and cancer, the right to have too little to eat, the right to be lousy, the right to live in constant apprehension of what may happen tomorrow, the right to catch typhoid, the right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind. There was a long silence. I claim them all, said the savage at last. Thank you.
Professor Raj Pasod, consulting psychiatrist from Maudsley Hospital. At the London School of Economics, he was responding to a talk by Lord Richard Layard about his challenge to policymakers to create a society more inducive to the happiness of its citizens. At this point, there were questions from the audience, and the first asked whether we are more unhappy now than in ancient times. No, said Lord Layard, and he reminds the audience of the short and rather brutal lives of people not so long ago, and the very tough life early humans faced.
Of course, a very long-standing issue is the noble savage. From Rousseau and others, you have the idea that civilization is an encumbrance and that the happiest thing is to be in a primitive society, essentially. On the whole, I think that's been shot apart. I think we should be rather proud of our society. I don't think we should think that we've got the worst of all worlds. I think we've probably got just about the best of all worlds that have been. But I'm also quite sure we could be better. And I think that the variety of happiness reports in different advanced countries is interesting. In general, the Scandinavian countries and Switzerland come out in many, many surveys as happier than the rest of the advanced world. They come out as more trusting, and I think they have better and more equal human relationships. And I think what we've discovered is that income, at our level of income, is unimportant relative to human relationships. I mean, I stress the problem of having a society in which we had developed a value system of people trying to get ahead of each other, which is impossible because it's a zero sum. And I think it's a real issue. It's actually almost inevitable public issue, how you view that. You see, you can say the state shouldn't get into that, but the state is in it. The state absolutely inevitably has to take a view on how competitive or cooperative a set of values it wants its actions to promote in the society. And I really worry that if you take, as it were, a libertarian point of view, it tends to lead to the very individualistic point of view and the very competitive end of the spectrum. And I don't think that's going to produce a happy society.
Lord Richard Layard doesn't advocate more regulations, but says it's an issue of degree of intervention to create a certain social climate. There cannot be an infinite welfare safety net, but a safety net is needed nonetheless. Also, the state must provide at least basic education, but no education is value-free. And even in the broader sense, society is teaching values. Against this backdrop, members of the audience were interested in the effects of social pressures on individuals. One asked Professor Pasod about his take on the role of entertainment in society.
There are several different ways in which the entertainment industry would have a negative impact. One is just about the value system it espouses, which tends towards superficial values. But there are a couple of other interesting things, which is that entertainment, by and large, tends to move people towards passivity. You passively sit on your sofa at home and consume television. And all the happiness literature is fairly clear that watching television, a lot of television, is not good for your happiness. And that basically happiness is about being active. It's about out there doing stuff, engaging with life, engaging with other people. And entertainment tends not to promote that. But here's another really interesting theory, again from evolutionary psychology, which is that when you look at our brain size and compare that with other primates, they can calculate our brain size because most of our brain is actually there, not because it's about intelligence in terms of making tools. It's about social intelligence. It's about being able to interact with other people. And the size of your cortex then is directly related to the size of the kind of groups you tend to live in. And basically they can calculate that the kind of groups we should be theoretically living in, maximum size of which, from our ancestral environment, is about 100 to 200 people. Okay? Now, if you compare yourself with a group of 100 to 200 people, you're likely to find certainly many people in that group who are a bit more attractive than you, or a bit more sophisticated or charming than you, but they're not likely to be enormously more attractive than you in that small sample. Take the entertainment industry now. You're going to find on your television screen, of the 6 billion people on the planet, one or two of the most attractive of the 6 billion. And you're going to be comparing yourself with these incredibly, startlingly attractive people. And Richard's written about this very eloquently in the book. Does that comparison process actually not have a corrosive effect? And one recent experiment found that when men, and it's interesting, it's always men, were shown magazine pictures of models of the opposite sex, and then asked to rate their commitment to their current relationship, their commitment was less just a few minutes after seeing pictures of models from magazines. So think about the cumulative corrosive effect of people comparing themselves with other people who appear to be doing a lot better. And again, Richard advocates that something should be done about that. I'm more uncomfortable about the idea of regulating this stuff. What I want to go down the route is of educating people as to the dangers of the entertainment industry and then leaving it to people to make decisions for themselves. But I think we differ on that one.
Well, I don't want regulation, but I did want to mention the fact that there is an experiment with women also, where women were shown pictures of models and they felt a lot worse afterwards.
They felt worse about themselves in terms of their comparison in fact, they eating disorder symptomatology went up after seeing pictures of models. So there is an interesting question about the corrosive effect on our happiness levels of the entertainment industry in general and the modern media.
Professor Raj Prasad adds that there is an important distinction that should be made when thinking about happiness.
I didn't have time to go into it in my talk, but a very important point is that there are two separate systems for desire, i.e. wanting stuff, and the system for enjoying stuff. And that has interesting implications if they're two different systems, because it sometimes means that sometimes the stuff we really want and desire and spend a lot of time pursuing, when we eventually get it, doesn't actually give us as much pleasure as we thought it would give us. And this is illustrated by a fascinating treatment that psychologists prescribe for unhappy people called pleasant activity training, or PAT for short. And it's very simple. All they do is they ask you to list the things that you enjoy doing most in your life, about 5 or 10 things. And lo and behold, when people do more of those things, they find themselves enormously happier. Okay? So which raises the question, well, why weren't they doing that in the first place? Well, the reason they weren't doing it was because often they were pursuing things, what they desired led them to pursue stuff. Often when they got that stuff, it didn't make them that much happier. So that raises an interesting question that, again, Richard brings up, which is we need to worry a bit about the aspirations that a modern corporate capitalist society builds in, the desires it encourages, in that does it put people on a hedonic treadmill, which is a term that psychologists use? Does it mean that people are constantly desiring stuff, and yet when they get it, they discover that it's not the kind of fulfilling thing they thought it was going to be all along, and they just then embark on yet another set of desires?
Because the most surprising thing is that in the land of the free, where you wouldn't think the government would be interested, namely America, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is including questions about happiness for the next 4 years in its surveys, quite detailed ones. Because, I mean, it can't be a sensible approach to policy not to know who the least happy people are in your society, how they're progressing, and in general how the society itself is progressing. And you may know that the Nobel Prize in Economics was given 2 years ago to a psychologist. This never happened before. Very good sign. And he has been very instrumental in developing more careful ways of measuring how people are experiencing their life and how they're feeling by repeated sampling and the different periods of day and so on. He and many psychologists in America are being rather successful in, they like to call it national happiness accounts. You see, it sounds right. The word account is very good.
Well, I want to pick up on that point. It's very important because Daniel Kahneman was the person you're talking about, a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Now, his work actually has a very profound implication for the measurement of happiness. And just to summarise very briefly one of the studies he did, and again, I'm slightly surprised he got Ethics Committee approval, but basically he did a study where people had a colonoscopy, which is a very painful procedure,
And in one condition, they had a colonoscopy which lasted a certain length of time, was extremely painful. In the second condition, they had exactly the same colonoscopy with the same length of time, but there was slightly less pain at the end of the procedure. They engineered it this way, but this is after the same length of time of pain had occurred as in the first condition. Remarkably, people in the second condition rated the second colonoscopy as less painful or more pleasant than the first. Yet, objectively, they'd had as much pain. It just after the pain had gone by, they just had a slightly less painful experience right at the end. And the conclusion is that when people are asked to judge happiness, they often focus on the intensity of the experience, i.e. the peak bit of how awful it was, and then the end bit. Okay, and that may explain why people are often very unreliable in their judgment of happiness. And that may explain why, very often, they make bad decisions. They decide to pursue stuff that they think is going to make them happy, and then in the end they discover when they get there, it didn't make them as happy as they thought it would. And Daniel Gilbert, a professor of psychology at Harvard, has done a lot of work on how hopeless we are at predicting how happy certain things will make us. And he asked people to predict how happy they thought they would be, depending on certain events, like getting a job or losing a job, and actually they were absolutely hopeless at predicting future happiness depending on certain events. And what's fascinating about that is every single decision we make is probably based on the idea that whatever we do, like going shopping or pursuing this job or doing this homework, we're factoring in how happy we think it's going to make us in the long run. What Gilbert is saying is we're no good at that decision, which has really profound implications for basically every decision we make in life. And I want to go back to the point that I would be worried about governments saying, well, you know, you guys are really bad at this decision-making stuff. We're going to take over and help you with those decisions. I think people should be educated about the fact that they're error-prone when it comes to these decisions. But hopefully with that education, they'll be moved to a place where they can make better decisions over happiness.
Both Richard Layard and Raj Basod agree that a lot of money isn't the source of greater happiness. But obviously, terrible poverty makes people very unhappy. Why then, asked a member of the audience, do politicians continue to focus on growth and wealth and consumerism as signs of good society? And moreover, why do people pay attention instead of keeping the simple life?
This goes back to the interesting question about what we think we desire. And in a way, politicians are trying to pander to that. And again, what's really important about Richard's book is he's putting that question right back at the center stage of public policy, which is, what should we desire? And in a way, there's a sense in which people skate over that question and make implicit assumptions about that. And that's because we think we're good at that kind of decision-making. We think we're good at the idea that because we desire a second house or a bigger car or a different commute, that we are making the right decision. The evidence is that very often we make those decisions, we arrive at the end state, and actually it doesn't produce the well-being that we thought it would. And I think that means that maybe a key part of education should be about these issues, about these psychological issues. It's fascinating to me that you get taught algebra, for example. I don't know about you, but I've never used algebra since I left school. And yet we don't get taught things like coping skills, how to make better decisions, etc., etc. And might the educational project be something where some of this stuff should be in, I think?
Yeah, let me offer a thought about politicians. I think it's quite difficult to get anything done if you're a politician. So how do you sort of mobilise situation in which you can get something done? You make people feel scared that the existing situation is untenable. You tell them life is really tough. You tell them there's an almost insuperable threat from India and China. Unless they get off their back seats, they're going to be at the same income level as India and China. I mean, a lot of this is tales to frighten the children. And it's kind of understandable that the politicians would try and generate this sort of anxieties in order to get their reforms through. It's understandable employers would try and generate these kind of anxieties in order to get change in their businesses. But I think, in a way, the most important point I was trying to make in my book is, what is our true situation? Our true situation is that we are inexorably becoming richer all the time. Two forces: one, science, that's the most important, but also actually globalization, bringing products to us cheaper than we ever had them before, raising our incomes. Of course, there's a little threat in some particular industries, but in general, this process, as we know from hundreds of years of history of trade, is a major source of higher incomes. We now have this ability to be richer and richer and richer. The issue is, how should we use it? Should we say to ourselves, and this is the extraordinary thing which is going on, well, we may be becoming 2% richer a year, but my God, it's got to be 2.25%, because otherwise somehow everything's going to fall apart. Or should we say, no, I mean, 2% is pretty good. In fact, if we could be a little more secure, which we know is what people want, why don't we even take 1.75%? Instead of which, we are subjected to a sort of ideological barrage, largely coming across the Atlantic, that everything's got to be more competitive, that there must be, if I can just take a little tilt at you, there's got to be more and more personal choice in respect of everything. For example, we happen not to have in England, but in most countries, they have a functioning pension system, public pension system. If you've got that, no, no, you should take responsibility for your own pension. That they're going to have to handle the unknown and the unforeseeable increasingly. And now you've got this extraordinary view, which is obviously completely wrong, that there are many people, according to the surveys, people in their late teens or early 20s, who think they're not going to be as rich as their parents. I mean, this is completely fatuous. It's inconceivable that that should come about. And yet, this is the atmosphere of fear and anxiety that has been created. And the idea that it's perfectly okay to want to be secure and let's help people to be secure is being derided in many of the speeches of the leaders of the Western world. That's what I'm against. I think that unprecedented riches should be used to give us the things which we want, which include security.
Can I just make a closing comment then, which kind of endorses that? And going back to the point about politicians, I actually think politicians are being rather clever psychologically, because one of the things they've understood, if you look at the evolutionary psychology of emotion, it makes sense that negative emotions like fear and anxiety are actually emotions that tend to grab us and hold on to us more than positive emotions. Because fear and anxiety kept us alive thousands of years ago. Because if you didn't feel fear and anxiety when a lion was bounding towards you, your life ended kind of rapidly. And it made sense, therefore, that fear and anxiety were very arresting emotions, and that we were vigilant, and if there was a possibility of fear and anxiety, we would latch on to that. So there's a natural biological tendency to orientate ourselves towards negative emotions. And politicians have understood that, which is why they use fear in election campaigns. They make you frightened of the asylum seekers, or Iraq, or the Russians, or the communists. And that's how they get you to mobilise, to vote. And wouldn't it be great if instead of this use of fear, which makes evolutionary sense, but actually in modern-day society doesn't make sense, that we had politicians that pandered more or encouraged more that we thought about positive emotions, like happiness and well-being, and encouraged ourselves to orientate ourselves towards positive emotions, like well-being, and that we voted on that rather than voting on fear.
What a perfect ending.
Today's Background Briefing is an edited version of a debate held at the Centre for Economic Performance at the London School of Economics. Speakers were Lord Layard, Professor of Economics at the school. His most recent book is called Happiness, Lessons from a New Science, and it's published by Penguin. And Professor Raj Basod is a consultant psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital, and he teaches at the King's College London. His most recent book, The Motivated Mind, published by Bantam Press. Coordinating producer, Linda McGuinness. Technical production, John Jacobs. I'm James Carlton. You're with ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.